and welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasures found within his pages. And now, on to the class.
As we start today talking about Joseph Smith looking towards the possibility of martyrdom and reading something like Fox's Book of Martyrs is one of those things that was apparently on his mind quite a bit. Now I think that it's interesting if you think about that we've talked over and over about the fact that Joseph so often framed the church in terms of Old Testament setting. And what he was doing, this is an Old Testament church. So you look at the prophets of the Old Testament, what happened to the prophets of the Old Testament?
The ones that God didn't warn to go someplace?
Yeah.
He allowed to be martyred.
Yeah, sometimes. What else? What about Moses? Yeah. What about Elijah? Yeah. What about Isaiah? Oh, we got sawed in half. Yeah. And so there was this, and Jeremiah could have been killed, but he had to stick around and watch the fall of Jerusalem and all of that. And so, but then if he starts taking a look at the prophets and the leaders of the New Testament, what happens to those guys? Well, that's a mess, right? Peter? Upside down, crucified, Paul, probably beheaded in Rome because he was a Roman citizen. Okay, you get that. You don't have to suffer, but you will die. Okay, and so there was this ongoing thing that prophets don't always make it. Prophets pay for it a lot of times with their life. And so I think as time was kind of coming together, he began to realize the question is, how do I go out? What happens ultimately to me? And that's why he will say on the way to Carthage, I don't care how I'm killed, I just don't want to be hung.
Just as a little aside, being raised a Protestant, these were the stories that were our pioneer stories.
Oh,
and we used to sing about the martyrs and the people that were slain.
Oh, certainly.
And those were our pioneer stories as kids in primary.
Yeah, I think it was Irenaeus, and then a lot of the others they brought into the Colosseum, and just kind of knelt and were giving thanks that they got to suffer like Jesus did, and then go ahead and kill us, and it kind of took the fun out of it for them. But there were a lot of martyrs that were involved in the shedding of their blood to continue Christianity. So Joseph is becoming quite aware, as we've been talking about, the spring of 1844 is getting worse. They've had the Council of 50. Then we get conspiracy that begins to crank up. So when sometimes people say, well, how did Joseph Smith die, or why did he die, or who was behind his death? Well, that's a pretty complicated question, isn't it? I mean, take your pick. It's almost like a whodunit, you know, kind of thing. So here's the possibilities. There's probably a combination here. First of all, the Missouri law officials. Why was Missouri after him? Yeah, someone tried to shoot Governor Boggs, and of course they were, and by the way, Orrin Porter Rockwell spent, 2 months in prison because they were trying to pin it on him? but they believe that it had been ordered by Joseph Smith. I love the old wives' tale. I don't know if it's true that years later in Utah, they asked Porter Rockwell if he had shot Governor Boggs, and his answer was, "No, I didn't. He's still alive, ain't he?" Okay. But they had tried numerous times to come across the river and arrest Joseph Smith, and every time there were people out there watching for him, for these leaders, and Joseph would go into hiding, and they could never get him. Or if they arrested him once halfway to Quincy, I think, and then he pled habeas corpus, we need to be able to be arraigned, so they take him back to Nauvoo, and he was released in Nauvoo. So they're increasingly frustrated. Okay.
So was there ever a resolution?
No, there really wasn't. There never. He lived. He did live, but no, there really wasn't. They just always had assumed that Joseph Smith had ordered it. Yeah, he was. He was in his house, and somebody shot through a front window. Yeah. Yeah, he recovered from his wounds.
So was it probably church member?
I don't think it was. He had a lot going on there. And could it have been Porter Rockwell?
No. No.
Still alive.
Yeah, he's still alive? No. I don't think so.
If I'd have been there, I would have taken a shot and he'd been dead. And I think it's ill advised. I'm not saying
oh, yeah, they're already stirred up enough.
But I would have done it.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Okay. So, could have been Missouri. And, in fact, we know that a large part of the mob that comes to Carthage is from Missouri. And we know who ordered that one. So, I'll get to it. Could be local Masonic groups. Why were the local Masons upset? He's bringing women in, yeah. That's right. How dare you do that? And not only that. Remember, in Masonry, there's a process of you need to be recommended. You've got to be able to prove that you're a good person, and all that. And that's why the Relief Society was the same sort of way. You don't just join Relief Society. You got to be recommended by somebody. It had the Masonic structure to it. But dang it, Joseph was admitting a lot of people into it, and they were doing it, but women were now a part of it, so they were changing all of that. So there was a local Masonic groups were upset, and the death penalty things were kind of there for
Masonry. But he wasn't admitting them into Masonry. He was admitting them into something that they viewed as a copy of Masonry.
Sure, yeah. And if you understood it and you saw some of the symbols that we were incorporating, yeah, it would very much, from the outside, it would very much look like we just had this, we kind of stole their stuff. So
we're a Protestant Masonry.
That would be a good way to put it. Yeah, okay, Missouri's upset. Masons are upset. Then there's Thomas Sharp and the Warsaw Signal. Bless his pointed head.
That's the Green Press?
Yeah. He was the editor of the Warsaw Signal, and he was a little concerned about. So I always think about Thomas Sharp. If you're coming into Missouri, you're coming in on the bottom side. You come through Keokuk, you cross the Keokuk Dam, and then you get to that crossroads. And you can either go left to Nauvoo, you can go straight to Carthage, or you can go right to Warsaw. Take your pick. Okay, it's one of those three. Now, down there, they had invited Thomas Sharp the first time that the Mormon Battalion was the Nauvoo Legion was marching in file in Nauvoo. And he's sitting on the stand watching all of these. They had state-issued rifles, and they were 500 strong. And Sharp began to be really concerned about what he saw, that they were a significant military force in this area now. And from that moment on, and then as he goes along, he becomes more and more antagonistic and more and more antagonistic. And it will be Thomas Sharpe's the Warsaw Signal that is calling for that we need to rise up now. It's horrible. This is after the expositor destruction. And rise up with powder and ball. The time to act is now. You know, and he's stirring it up. Now, in the Sharpe will do two things. Sharpe is going to actually reach out to Missouri. These guys that are running around, he will kind of set up something with them. And then he will actually be, he is one of the six defendants that will be tried for the murders of Joseph and Hiram. And they will say, we're glad you did it, but not guilty. You know, yeah, we know you did it. We know you're behind it, but Thomas Sharpe is a big figure in this. So he's upset and he's stirring up, and he's a Mason in Warsaw. So he's driving that as well. Okay. So plural marriage is unraveling. We've been trying to keep a lid on it, but more and more information is coming out. Again, some of those that Joseph has approached, like Nancy Rigdon, daughter of Sidney, she's upset, she's offended, and she's not keeping her mouth shut. That you know, Joseph was hitting on me. You know, he's suggesting these things, and it's horrible. And so some of the women, there's a couple of women that Joseph had approached to have their family sealed, his family by virtue of this sealing, takes that as you're just hitting on me, and they're not quiet about it. So, and then certainly the expositor will really then take the lid off of that. So that's why you're getting hundreds of people coming to the meetings of the Wilson and William Law House. So
was there any other cultural group that had plural marriage that was accepted in the United States at that time?
There were, I was looking that up. There were a couple of people that had kind of, remember, there were a lot of people at this time, kind of this manifest destiny, millennialists are coming. And so you had these groups like the Shakers and a few others that were trying different forms of religion. And there were a couple of guys in, leaving out Islam. I mean, everybody knew Mohammedanism was doing this, but there were some on the East Coast that were sort of practicing this at some level, but they kind of shot down pretty fast, but they didn't have a 500-person army to back it up.
I belong to the Jewish community. There were Orthodox Jews.
Orthodox Jews? Really? I don't know that.
But the men would come completely clothed in dark.
Right, Hasidic.
Not all of them Hasidic. But there would be a wife and many children. Very discreet.
Wow. Now you're going to make, I'm going to have to go do some research. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah.
I heard Abraham had more than one wife.
That's why I heard that. Yeah. Yeah.
There's from teaching genealogy at the college, there were a lot of these groups, and they were, a lot of them were involved with these utopian societies.
Right.
And
right.
One of them that was really popular in New York was the Oneida group.
Yes.
And they're the people who make Oneida Silver, and that's how they supported their commune, and it was a big building. And it's very hard now, because when I first heard about this, I was like kind of shocked.
Yeah.
I didn't know that people don't know about all of this going on, but it's involved in a lot of these utopian societies.
Yeah.
It made me feel better about being a church.
So we're not quite so alone.
Yes, I'm looking at it and I'm saying, wow, some of these people had some really crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But,
well,
it's very hard to find even the Oneida group now. It's hard to find it even on the internet. You can find it all about the Mormons, but you can't. It's hard to hard to find about these other.
Yeah, they don't have a Broadway musical. Okay, so that was unraveling. The other thing that was unraveling, of course, were those guys that were hearing about plural marriage and taking that as a semi-permission to go do spiritual wivery, which is, I do want to hit on a woman, but we'll say that we're kind of spiritually married, so it's okay. You know, I can seduce you, but we're sort of married, because Joseph Smith is doing something similar. And so people like John C. Bennett, who had left a family in Ohio to come out and do this, he was doing that. Wilson Law had several women that had talked about how he was hitting on them. Yeah.
You know anything about Orson Pratt? When one of the other members of the church went off on a mission someplace, he tried to get his wife.
Orson Pratt. Yeah. Remember? See, Sarah is still there. I mean, she was like. Orson had been on a mission, and he loved the Pratt brothers, and he loved Orson. So he's trying to explain to Sarah, I'm going to be sealed to you so that I can seal you and Orson to me. She took it badly. Orson Pratt.
Joseph.
Oh,
Joseph, okay.
Yeah, and remember, that's when Orson comes back. She says, Joseph was approaching me. My honor is hurt. And so Orson becomes suicidal. He goes, and several of the brethren, Brigham Young and a couple of others, find him on a sandbar in the Mississippi. And they go and they talk him into coming back. But yeah, that was Orson's big trial. And those things are out there, because I don't think Sarah ever quite forgave that.
Wasn't it Orson Pratt that introduced Section 132 in the 1852?
Yeah, it was. And again, there was at that point when the church was saying yes to the world, we do practice polygamy, this plural marriage, it's a sacred thing. And he has a series of celebrated meetings with some prominent ministers from the East that come out, and in the tabernacle, they have this big prominent thing where he's proving from the Bible that polygamy is okay. And Orson's a big advocate at that point.
But why Orson Pratt? Why wasn't it done by
Brigham Young,
the presiding officer? Why? And wasn't Orson Pratt like just a mid-tier apostle? Wasn't he like?
He was, but in some ways, Orson Pratt was the James Talmage, B.H. Roberts of his time. He was smart. He was intelligent. On my mission, I'd found in England, we were in a little bookseller thing in Manchester, England, and I found an old book called Discourses of Orson Pratt that I bought. And I carried that on my mission, and sometimes when I was supposed to be doing like scripture study, I was reading Orson Pratt, and he had talks like means of locomotion in the future state, meaning in the millennium, how will we travel around? So he was talking about means of locomotion in the future state, or he was talking about how the day will come that Israel will march from Utah to Missouri with a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day, and that we were going to duplicate the children of Israel coming out of the desert back to Missouri.
I just want to say, a lot of people believe that. Very big. A lot of people were planning on it.
My pioneer grandfather, it was shortly before he died in 1901, where he was still, it was about 1900, I read in his journal, he says, I have to accept that we're not going back anytime soon. You know, he was just at that point, they still were, yeah.
So was plural marriage any source of the conflict between Parley Pratt and Orson Pratt?
No, it really wasn't, because again, how does How does Parley Pratt die?
He gets shot.
Yeah, why? Yes. Who had let, she saw Parley coming through New Orleans, I believe, and met him and joined the church, and he was abusive. And this was her chance to leave her husband. So she follows him up into Arkansas, but he's tracking, disgruntled husband is tracking Parley and kills Parley in Arkansas.
So
but because of plural marriage.
What was the conflict between Orson and Parley?
I don't think there was, I wasn't aware that there was one.
I
don't know.
I teach Sunday school, there was a point at which Orson writes a letter to Parley. They had had some type of a major disagreement.
Oh.
And it's genealogy, basically, that brings them back together, the fact that somebody was researching that.
Well, I do know, and I think it's Parley writing to Orson, and this Truman Madsen talks about this, where he says, I believe that we have a common ancestor that unites all the first generation of the church. I've looked, I can't find it. And Archibald F. Bennett, genealogist at the turn of the century, finds him, and his name is John Lathrop. And when they track back to John Lathrop, they can prove that the Smiths and the Youngs and the Pratts and the Woodruffs are all kind of tied into the same genealogy, which was why I was thrilled. I mean, on vacation a few years ago, we were on Cape Cod, and I found the Lathrop Cemetery and was thrilled to find that the Hinckleys had married in second generation to the Lathrops. I'm like, yes, we're part of the vaunted group. Yeah.
He was just talking about what brought them back together.
And it was that bonding.
Yeah, but he makes reference to the fact that they'd had kind of a public disagreement, and they stopped talking to each other for a number of years.
Which would be hard to do because they were always, Parley and Orson, Orson was always pushing back against Brigham Young. Parley was too, but Brigham Young just kept sending him on missions. You know, he went to Chile, he went to the islands of the sea, you know, he just always sent, Parley was always gone. I'm surprised he had any children from never being around. So
I've got a book at home that tells about that. I can't remember the name of it. I remember it's an old book, and it shows their genealogy because our family has the Pratt in it.
Okay.
And we also have Bennett, which I'm not happy about.
Well, congratulations. Yeah.
And Bennett was also, or Bigfoot was also an ancestor of at least four presidents of the United States.
His genealogy, because remember, it's John. The reason why John Lathrop is a reformist in England, and he's speaking out against the Church of England, and they kick him out of his pulpit, and then he brings people in mass to Massachusetts. Thomas Hinckley comes from him, but when you go into the Lathrop Cemetery, this is where the who's who of everything. And it's like 5 miles from Plymouth Rock. It's right there. But Lathrop is kind of our patron, common ancestor of the church, for sure.
Wasn't the Manamon massacre somewhat connected with Parley's killing as well in Arkansas?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it really was, because that's happened right at the time. That's 1857, early 1857. And within just a few months, and their claim, so there's some feelings against Arkansas to begin with, and the Francher Party actually is coming from near where Parley was killed. And so yeah, when we get to Mountain Meadows, we'll, good point. So you were thinking?
Oh, well, Mountain Meadows, I'm just thinking that there's a good people that do the wrong thing, you know, like Governor Boggs.
You're still thinking about shooting Governor Boggs, aren't you?
People are talking about this. People believe in that we're going to go with a pillar and a cloud and all that. And there are three or four scriptures that talk about pray that your flight be not in winter, and that if you're pregnant, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I think a lot of Latter-day Saints look at those scriptures, and maybe some of them are prep-ish because of that.
Yeah,
but
right.
There's about nine scriptures that says that we're not going to go by flight nor in haste.
Yeah.
The ones that are going to have the flight that they need to worry about are the wicked and those in Jerusalem.
Yeah. Well, remember, too, that, you know, speaking of the Pratt brothers, remember, again, we've talked about how literal those guys were. The 1800s, they were literalists, you know. And so, again, they're seeing the scriptures. This is going to actually literally happen. There wasn't any symbolism for these guys. Okay. But what's going to happen in Nauvoo is that Joseph is now publicly calling out John C. Bennett. Wilson Law, who is a lieutenant colonel in the Nauvoo Legion, they court-martial him. They excommunicate. He excommunicates in April the Wilson brothers. And of course, William had been in the first presidency. So he was cleaning house. And you know, think about at that time, it's like the law of the West is, sir, my honor has been abused, you know, and this is about an honor thing, and I must have recompense, you know. And so their honor has been, so I read a letter from Wilson Law to Joseph Smith talking about, you have impugned my honor, sir, you know, and if you will recant, I shall extend the right hand of fellowship, and until then, you know, you are a scoundrel, you know. And they're just, so anyway, they have been, they're being called out.
No, you know, you see how literal they were. We may look back and think, oh, really? Maybe whatever. You think about it, Joseph's first vision, the restoration of the priesthood, the things that happened in the Kirkland Temple. Why wouldn't they think that these things?
Anything could happen. Well, like I've mentioned, though, that literal thinking means I look at a scripture, and if we get a sense from King Follett that we're going to have offspring in the eternities, then they'd look at women and say, in life, how long does it take you to be pregnant with a baby? 9 months. Therefore, in heaven, you'll be pregnant for 9 months. You know, and they would just extend that kind of, anyway. Yeah, I don't think he was. They're just going to do this, right?
A day is 1,000 years, so that's a really long pregnancy.
Yeah, I know, but like I've said, I've read from certain women's groups talking about, I don't want to go to the celestial kingdom where I'm going to be in the eternal womb. You know, I'm going to be pregnant for the eternities. I don't think so. Okay. All right, so we got that. Details of the Council of 50 are leaking out, talking about we're putting up a civil central government that will rule the world during the millennium, which sounds like they're wanting to make Joseph a king. And I think it's Wilford Woodruff who says, I want to be king of France. So, you know, that sounds pretty threatening. And you got an army to back it up. And then finally, and this is President Oakes' belief. He wrote a book in the 70s where he called this a political assassination, that really the presidential campaign was the driving force for Thomas Sharp and others to organize this, because it would be one thing for him to be out there as a prophet, but if he gets elected, it could get bad. And I'm going to read you a couple of, when we get done, I'll read you a couple of responses from some of the New York papers, where you kind of begin to see that wasn't as far-fetched as you might think, how he was actually being seen, especially when he has a solution to polygamy and he has a solution for what we do with Texas and all of those, that some of the platforms he's putting out here aren't half bad. Okay, we may not believe his religion, but that's not a bad idea. Okay, so take your pick. There are a lot of groups that are all coming together, and now they know that all of this is stirred up. So you got inside the church. We know that these guys are meeting and they're doing blood oaths. That we're going to kill the prophet. We got people on the outside, Missouri. Thomas Sharp is talking, and actually John C. Bennett went to Richmond, Virginia, to talk to him and said, "I can help you do this." He's kind of a Judas in trying. So there's the groups are gathering, and militias are gathering, and they're gathering arms, and they're ready to go. Yeah.
These are my people, and I'm really offended. But I can't help but think about where we come.
Yeah, well, and see, that's why there is a certain amount of it where we go, a crazy religious leader who's claiming all of these things from the outside looking in, it would look like, especially based on what you're hearing from other people, because think about a few things said, and then, well, here's what I heard. I heard Joseph Smith, you know, talks to the devil, and whatever it is, you could stir people up with a lot of lies, like it happened in Missouri, like it was happening in New York, like it happened in Kirtland. Now it's happening, but it's on a bigger scale, because the church is now not just vulnerable people sitting in Far West. This is a group with an army and structure, and at their head is a Illinois-appointed Major General, Joseph Smith, who has the ability to command an army. They're more dangerous. Yeah, here and here.
Well, I was just thinking about present day, and we see how, no matter what your politics are, the Columbia University protests that were there, even what's happening with Elon Musk and Tesla, people get ganned up over, you know, and you can just...
And conspiracy, and we don't do conspiracies now. But
no.
Imagine if they'd had the internet back then. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
John and I were right on the same page. He was listing out, you know, when this happens, and I was going to say, yeah, and now. But I don't understand why the crazies choose to believe the propaganda. I said crazies, but you know, some of them are related to me. Not this one. But, you know, why is it that people buy into and grasp the propaganda when they have that in one hand and the truth in the other? They choose to believe that.
They choose to believe which voices? The ones that kind of validate what they're thinking anyway.
It's good that none of us are ever confused.
No, not at all. Yeah.
At least from what I recall as a senior in high school in seminary class, the way the seminary teacher, one thing he presented was that when Joseph was granted the Nauvoo Charter, that it was, the state did it in the attitude of religious freedom, and they gave the Nauvoo Charter wide latitude. It was almost like
wider than most cities.
It was like they were a nation unto themselves.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They resented doing, you know, they ended up resenting giving him that.
Sure. And the other cities were resenting that Nauvoo got that, and they didn't. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Okay, so take your pick. There's a lot of this whodunit, and in some ways it was a combination of all of these guys coming together. Okay, all right. So we need is a match to light the fire, set the blaze on fire, right? And of course that was the Nauvoo Expositor. William Law was in the process of forming a little church. He was going to start pulling all people towards him. But they come up with the Nauvoo Charter. I was going to spend a long time on this. I don't want to. But starting about right here, this piece over here talks about how Joseph on one side has brought out plural marriage was one thing. And then the duality of gods was super offensive to them. It's like the two major things, this idea of plural marriage was horrible and awful, and But the duality of gods, with the idea going back to the Council of 50, duality of gods, and Joseph is going to be their king and all that. And they're just spinning, man. They're just, and so they call it the Nauvoo Expositor, meaning what? The Nauvoo Exposer. We're going to expose this thing. Okay. And again, if you walk up Mulholland Street, if you go from the temple and you go up Mulholland Street, there's Zion's Mercantile over here, and then there's a bookstore just a little bit farther up past the little Nauvoo Hotel thing that sits right there. Right across from that is where the Expositor building was, right on Mulholland. Okay. And it prints this one on June 7th. And it's so bad and so malicious that the Nauvoo Council meets for a long, long time. They debate on and on and on. And finally they decide, by order of the city council, you are to this constable, you are now here commanded to destroy the printing press from whence issues the Nauvoo Expositor and the type of said printing establishment in the street. Burn the furniture, the little pieces of wood that they would use to make the press. Burn all the expositors and libelous handbills found in said establishment. Now, I think it's ironic that what happens in Far West as we're being driven out in 1833? They burned our truck in the middle of the street, okay? By a mob. This time it's the city council that, and if you look at the law for that, they were well within their right to debate, vote, come up very calmly to say this is a not nuisance and it needs to be destroyed, which they will then do. Now, were they well within their rights? Yes.
To make those decisions, I don't think the way they did it was within
power. Might not have been, but even if it was it prudent that they do this? No. At this moment of high excitement and everything, this literally was kind of the worst thing that they could have done.
I can't remember where I read it, but, you know, Dallin Oaks, of course, is a lawyer, and he wrote from the legal point of view on some of this, and he presented the point of view of religious freedom at the time. His, at least Dallin's interpretation of it, was that you were free to do religion so long as it was in a positive manner. You weren't to criticize other religions.
Yeah.
He pointed out that Joseph Smith would invite leaders of other religions and give speeches to the Latter-day Saints there. And so that was his idea of religious freedom, but you weren't to be critical. And so from that point of view, the expositor was counter to religious freedom.
Yeah, and that's why I say as they've looked through it, by and large, they were right to be able to shut it down. Now, shut it down by burning and destruction of property, well, I don't know, that's hard. But again, even if it was legal, worst thing that they could have done. Because this then will bring, now they can bring everybody together, now they can say Joseph Smith is out of control. And so they're screaming and yelling about it. They bring suit against it, against Joseph and the. So this is why in Carthage, when the original trial is going to be held, it's almost all of the city council. It's not just Joseph and Hiram. And it's so far out of control that this is going to have to pull in the governor to kind of mediate how they're going to do this. And it is true, for instance, that Thomas Governor. I remember it a sec. Anyway, he's actually going to come from Springfield, and he's going to come out, and they will stay at the Hamilton Hotel. Now, remember, before we even get here, remember that we do have this incident. We're all very, very aware of it. By the way, how many of you have been to Nauvoo? That's what I'm counting on. That you guys have. No, I'm not trying to belabor a lot of stuff that you guys haven't already heard. So we already know that Joseph, just prior to this, looks at it and says, "It's me they're after, and I can stop this whole thing by heading west." And he gets ready to leave, and we know he gets to the other side of the river. They ask him to come back. Emma sends a letter asking him to come back, and he does. If my life's of no value to my friends, it's no value to me. And he will go back, and he will voluntarily go up the road to Carthage to meet Governor Ford, Thomas Ford.
I've never heard. I know about the letter that Emma wrote, but did we have anything that talks about how she felt about this after she wrote that letter running back?
No, not really. We know that it was some of the brethren. We even know some of who they are. Who go to Emma after they find out that Joseph has left, and he says that he's left us. He said he wouldn't lead us, he wouldn't abandon us. He's left. Our home values will drop, but he's chickening out. He's running away from us, and so that's the word that she sends across the river. Porter Rockwell's heading back and forth across the river, and he gets out there and he says, "People feel like you've abandoned them. The shepherd has left the sheep." Is what the letter says. "You have abandoned us." And he says, "Well, if my life is of no value, then to my friends, no value to me. Hiram, what should we do? I think we could go back." He says, "No, if we go back, we'll be slaughtered. We'll go."
So why did they go to Emma and Emma write the letter? Why did they just write the letter?
Because they thought she would be more influential. Yeah, and she's walking down, and she's actually stopped on the street. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy that did it. Anyway, so he agrees to meet, and he drives all the way. They're almost to Carthage when they meet some of the Carthage Greys coming that way, and they said, "There is this, Governor Ford's waiting for you, but he's a little nervous that the Nauvoo Legion still has 500 rifles." And so he then turns around, he goes back to Carthage, back to Nauvoo, and they call for the rifles to be surrendered. And they surrender all of the arms, the government-issued arms. And then they turn around and go back that road, back up there then to Carthage. And they get in late, and that night they stay at the Hamilton Hotel. And I've walked that distance from the Carthage jail. You kind of head off like southeast, and it was about half a mile to where that Hamilton Hotel used to stay. And so they spend that first night in the Hamilton Hotel, and then they meet with him there, with Thomas Ford. They agree, meeting with the judge, that they post bail. We can now go home. Except that there are two guys that then claim that it's not so much the destruction of the expositor, but now he's committing treason, and Governor Ford says, I can't release you on a federal charge of treason, so we're going to have to hold you in jail, not at the Hamilton Hotel. So then Joseph will then link arms with Governor Ford. Because the Carthage Greys are camped outside the jail, he will link arm with them, and they will walk back through the crowd, and then they will make it to Carthage jail, where they will be put in the debtor's cell downstairs. Now, I thought this was really touching. Somebody's kind of tried to give a better view of what Emma might have looked at because I just want you to get a sense of this. This really touched me. On the morning of June 27th, he's going to dictate a long letter to Emma. And Willard Richards is going to write it down. And then I think it's interesting thing that happens right here. So this is in Willard Richards' handwriting down here. And then he hands it to Joseph to sign his name to it, which he signs. And then Joseph takes a moment to say, okay, if I'm signing it, let me add a personal note to Emma. And he's going to do this at 20 past 8, and this is on June 27th. So he keeps track of this, 20 past 8, first thing in the morning, and he's going to say in his own handwriting. So you can picture this moment in his where he is. And he says, so Joseph F. Smith, let me put a note. My dear Emma, I am very much resigned to my lot, knowing that I am justified and that have done the best that could be done. Give my love to the children. That will be his last communication to Emma. But I love this sense of, in his own handwriting, he just wants her to know, I have done the best that could be done. And I think if we're going to put something, if something could be put on his, in addition, on his headstone, I have done the best that could be done, to me, sums up everything that Joseph Smith was.
Why did he not write the entire letter himself?
Never did, usually. Almost always, he will dictate, because he's slow. He's a little slower to write. And so almost everything that we have, letters from Joseph to almost anybody, is in somebody else's handwriting. He dictates. We just have very, very few letters written in his own hand.
So they were worried about him being a dictator.
And he was dictating. Very nice. Thanks, Jim. Groan's done. Okay, go ahead.
Was it a cultural thing at the time? I mean, if I were writing a letter to my wife, I would sign it, Don, right, rather than Joseph F. Smith.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. That's why there is something about this, and because even then it's just, you've got it. He's saying the governor continues his courtesy, permits us to see our friends. We heard he won't go down with the troops today. And I like this where he says, think he's got a memory here. Of course, we will obey the order the government offers us and render them assistance. There is no danger of any exterminating order. Should there be mutiny among the troops, which we do not anticipate. A part will remain loyal and stand for the defense of the states and our rights. There's one principle that is eternal. It's the duty of all men to protect their lives and the life of their household. Remember that when he's shooting through the door and trying to protect the brethren in the room. And no power has the right to forbid. So he's still pretty, at this point, it's still pretty formal. Joseph Smith but Emma, my dear Emma, I'm resigned knowing that I'm justified. Yeah.
I was
going to
say that part is very much how they talked about
that. It was.
They
had a formal.
That's the way all the communicators was. They were not a mushy, lovey-dovey type. Stopping.
No,
it was
just
the facts. You're going to get the facts, and this is it. Not going to be emotional.
No, but we're going to take 20 words to say one.
Right.
It's just this expanded view of things. But that's why this last little note just touched me when I read
right.
It. It just seemed like
that's the
human part of him. Yeah, no question. Okay, yeah.
Well, all of us, I think, when we hear about this history, what a not good governor Governor Ford was.
Yeah.
And I believe when President Hinckley dedicated the Nauvoo Temple, I remember we would go.
I was about to say that.
And watch it. And he said that his life did not turn out well. He ended up changing his name.
Yeah.
But I'm from Illinois, so I can say this. I was born, reared, educated, and converted to the gospel there, so I can say this about my home state. I read that 4 out of the last 10 governors have gone to prison. Yeah. And there is, so I
one of them just got out.
About,
yeah.
There's something about that office that just doesn't do well.
I know.
People don't do well. And I have to tell you this joke. This is an Illinois joke. There are two men standing in line in a prison cafeteria line in Illinois, and one turns to the other and says, "The food was better when you were governor."
It has that reputation.
I saw a bumper sticker in Chicago. Our governors make our license plates in Illinois.
I do remember, though, anybody else remember that little quip from during the dedication of the Nauvoo Temple? When President Hinckley is, and I can't remember, and he's kind of leaning a little bit into the fate of the prosecutors or those that had killed Joseph Smith and everything, and he just says, and Governor Ford's life was horrible and his kids fell apart or something. And then at the end of that, I guess I shouldn't be saying that. You know, and I'm guessing that if you go back and look, I'll bet some of that is edited out, but you could really tell that President Hinckley still had some feelings about that. And I know because I know what our ancestors were doing, the Hinckleys there. But anyway, I just think that's okay. So ahead of that, then, Carthage Jail, of course. They finally put the water pump back in. We know that and I'll show in a sec. On the back side of that is the debtor's cell where they spent the first night. And then we know that day that they had been around in the kitchen. When you go through the Carthage Jail, of course, the original floor is still there. And it's true that the jailer, when he comes in, says that he can hear some things out there. You guys will be safer upstairs. So they spend the afternoon upstairs. And of course, the mob is going to come from this direction and come in through that side door. We know the room. And at one point, they had the bed on the other side. That's where the bed was. And again, most of you, I think, have been there.
So the bed wasn't tucked over in the edge where they show it?
No. It's amazing when some of the movies that have been made showing this, it's like Joseph being shot and he falls through the plate glass window, you know, big dramatic thing. Okay. Now, I always find this interesting. This is the top of the stairs and the cell is over here. I'll show you that in a second. But the mob comes up here and I know that... I think it's Willard Richards that records, or John Taylor, records that one of the things in the afternoon while they were waiting, that the guards were asking some questions about the church, and that Joseph sat near the top of the steps here with the jailers down here and preached a sermon on the Book of Mormon. Okay? Well, his last, if you're going to ask where did Joseph give his last sermon, it was on the steps of the Carthage Jail in there. And I know that I've mentioned that with my sons, I always tried to, we would take a trip to Nauvoo together before they left on their mission. I did that with all three sons. And with my middle son, he was leaving in February. So we went up in the middle of, like, the first week of February. And stayed in Keokuk, and then we went to Nauvoo, went through the temple, came back, and we woke up the next morning. We're going to go to Carthage, but there's a blinding snowstorm, and the snow is just bad. It is really, really bad. And we waited for the snow to settle down a little bit, and then we made a run for it. We came across the dam, came to that intersection, made straight for Carthage, and the snow is blowing across the road and everything. We pull into Carthage and there's like a foot and a half of snow and nobody's there. the jail is empty. Okay. And nobody's even parked there. And so here's this crazy car from Texas, and I'm driving around. I'm just trying to point out to McKay where we're going, and it's over here, and this is the door over here. That I'm trying to give him all this stuff. And one of the senior missionaries comes out of the house over here and he goes, are you wanting to see the jail? Yeah. Well, good. Well, come on in. So we just left the car parked in the middle of the road in the snowstorm, and we come trudging out there, and he led us into the jail. And we were there for about an hour and a half. Think about how fast the cattle call is these days. If you're there in July, you got about, you know, 30 seconds and take a picture and get out of here. Well, we had about an hour and a half, and we sat and we talked for a long time in each one of the places, and he just gave us time to sit and talk. And what touched me is that the senior missionary and I stood on these stairs and talked for a long time. I was aware of where we were. I was aware of the history. He was aware of the history. It was right here where Joseph, yeah, and tell me what you know. And it was fun. With all due respect, if I have a, it's not a pet peeve, but it's always interesting that so often when we go to church historical sites, they have the sweetest sisters. And they're there to tell you the story about these things. But so often they're from like Japan and Chile. And, you know, this is not their history. And they have learned this. They didn't know much about it until they got to these historical sites. And these wonderful sisters loved them. But sometimes if you can get an older senior missionary that has been studying the gospel all of his life, and he knows these stories really well. And in fact, the senior missionary that we were talking to there on the stairs, his ancestor was Cyrus Whitlock, who had given Joseph the little pistol that he used to shoot through the door at the mob. Okay, and he was aware of what happened that night before and all of that. But anyway, so we know that they come up the stairs. They know that they're standing on the landing. This is just shortly after. And that we know that the first, some of the first shots are going to come through the door. That one. Now, the part of the problem was, you can sort of see it, it's right here. They spent a lot of that afternoon, this was a bedroom up there. This was the jailer's bedroom. The door jamb was broken, and they spend a lot of the day trying to get it to shut. The door wouldn't shut. So they're whittling all day, and they're trying to get this piece whittled down enough that the door will actually shut and lock. And they never did, they weren't completely successful at it, but that's, they're actually there. And if you'll notice, it's cut out here, like that. One of the mob took a part of the door with him, took it home. And it was found years later in a family had passed it down and from the door of the Carthage jail. And they donated it back to the church. And so they went up and they tried it. And sure enough, it was a perfect fit. So we were able to restore having that there. But that's one of the reasons why they couldn't, they were not successful pushing against the door.
So was the shot that killed Hiram that came through the door, was that in response to Joseph being out?
No, not yet, because he doesn't do that until Hiram falls dead. So there, and I've got a picture of it. I mean, there's all four brethren are like pushing against the door, and Hiram is in kind of in the middle position, and that's the ball that comes through and hits him just to the side of his nose. And see, let me back up a little bit. No, we'll go here. Okay. One of the things that I was first got to me the first time that we went, and I always have quite a feeling there, that again, if you're back up here, this door ends up opening to this cell. When Joseph falls out of the window and everybody runs back down the stairs to go get Joseph Smith, that leaves Willard Richards with a dead Hiram and a severely wounded John Taylor. And he's about ready to leave, and he hears from underneath the bed, because John had, when he tried to climb out the window, of course he shot, we'll talk about this in a sec, he shot from the outside, but he's also shot from the inside. and he will, and especially in his hip, it blows out a big chunk of his hip, and he rolls underneath the bed. Okay, and as Willard Richards is going to leave, he hears from underneath the bed, "Don't leave me!" You know, John Taylor with his. So I've always felt this moment in there. It gets quiet because everybody's gone. They're out there finishing off Joseph Smith, and Willard Richards will then will pull John Taylor from out from underneath the bed, around Hiram's body, across this floor here, and he will put him into this cell area, covered with straw, and as you know, all the straw helped stanch the blood and help stop the bleeding, but John Taylor will lay there and just bleed a lot. That's why when they did some renovations, they still found underneath the floor joists with John Taylor's blood underneath that. Okay, but this is a very lonely place, and John Taylor in his own reports will say that as they're coming across here, he can hear Wilson Law yelling up the stairs. You know, are they up there? Are they gone? And he recognizes some of the voices. This is one of those moments when they talk about that there were those in the mob who had received their endowments. That's part. So they are attacked by their friends. But anyway, that's always always just feel it. If you go up there, just get a chance to just kind of close your eyes and be in there. That's a moment right there. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, again, how do they know?
They knew that Wilson Law was there. Wilson was one that had received his endowments. Uh-huh. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think Fulmer is the one that Joseph lays on his arm the night before and kind of tries to rest. Yeah. I think Fulmer also had a pistol as well, if I remember right. Okay. All right. The story. This one is kind of interesting how this is evolving. John Taylor writes in his memoirs that when he is standing here, that he's shot and that his watch stops a bullet that saved his life. It was in his breast pocket, okay? And then, of course, then the other ball hits him on his hip. And he will say that, and this is his watch, and he's going to say that the watch saved my life, stopped the bullet, and I'd be dead if it wasn't for this watch, okay? Well, over time, people have looked at that. I don't know how many of you are good at. I'm not sure what size the balls were in the.
That ball wouldn't have gone more than an inch. It's too
small. Yeah. Oh, for sure. So looking at it and say, good story, but we're not sure that it would have shattered that watch because these were big balls. Okay. So for years now there has been. The general consensus has been that he was hit when he was hit in his hip, that it threw him against the windowsill, and that this is actually that it cracked it a bit as he's being thrown against the windowsill, so he wasn't really hit by a bullet. Okay,
that looks like shot to me. It looks like from a shotgun.
Yeah.
But that watch isn't substantial enough to stop something like that.
Here's
the punches pushes out on the back.
Yeah.
And the hole under the 12.
Here's the current thinking. And because this has just changed a little bit just in the last 5 years. Now they've had some ballistic experts looking at this thing, and the belief is that there's a good chance that this face was towards his inside his pocket, And this is the thing that's taking the blow, and that it's a bullet fragment. That one, and it could have been a shotgun thing, but that it's a bullet fragment, and so part of it is consistent with, and so there is a sense that says, maybe. And so now they're saying there's a possibility that it might have been that. John Taylor certainly believed that. Yeah.
So going back to your earlier comment that offended me.
Yes.
When the sisters were, you know, talking about this, and you said it's not their history. Your history is what you culturally embrace.
Yep.
From what you learned.
Oh, yeah.
And it was their history. And some of our history, you could say, it's fiction. Some of the things that are in our history are fiction.
For sure.
This is maybe there's a lot of fiction there or conjecture or whatever, but it was people's history for a long time. Now there'll be fewer people with that same history.
Yeah.
And they'll will have a different history that's maybe less wrong.
Or maybe, but it's not quite as miraculous. I mean, for the longest time, it's like God saved his prophets and he was saved by a, okay? So I get it. And that's part of why we look at history. It is.
But people choose their history from what they have available.
Yeah.
And now we've got browsers that it can give us entirely fictional history.
Well, or based on, but remember, we always look at our problem with history is that it's a foreign country. And we look through the eyes of presentism. We look through now. So if I ask you if Thomas Jefferson was a good guy or a bad guy, it depends on which window you're looking through and how you frame the founder of our nation or a slaver, or, you know, it depends on how you're getting, you will tell that history based on how you feel about it now.
I've heard it said there's no such thing as a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
There's a color and an agenda.
Sure. And most history is written by the winners, right?
And my mother just went through my grandfather's history and fixed it.
Yeah, Brett.
You
know, that's funny.
Watch, and I don't know about you guys, whether that was a bullet or a fragment or a shotgun shot or whatever, something hit that watch with a little bit of force.
It did.
I just assumed it hit my watch.
I think that's a good point. Okay. Yeah, all right. So we also have Hiram's clothes. Now, if you go into the Church History Museum, they have this laid out. That's what he was wearing. That day, you can say he took a shot to the knee. But the one that killed him was to his face. Yeah. By the way, if anybody asks, I'm happy to send the PowerPoint to you. Real quickly, we have the death mask. And from here, you can't, again, Hiram's bullet shot, when you look at this actual mask, you can see the on the other side.
Is that like a really common thing that they
use? Oh, for sure. Yeah, the plaster of Paris, they just put it on their face. And because they did a couple of interesting things that are different now. That's one, they put a mask. When they are brought back to, when they're brought the next day, when they're cleaned up a little bit and taken back to, in wagon and drive all the way from Carthage back to Nauvoo, this is the Nauvoo Mansion House, part of what we just purchased back from the Community of Christ. Okay. And in the old days at the time, and this was the hotel, they didn't move into that till 1843, so it had only been in there about 18 months.
So you said that the mob went out and finished Joseph Smith. What does that mean?
Oh, yeah. There are several different views of that. One is that, again, Joseph is going to stand at the window. He takes some shots from the outside. They say he took about 8 balls between the back and the front, and that he then pitches out the window, and both Willard and John, even John's looking up and he can see his feet disappearing out the window. And he falls against the pump house, against the pump that's there. And members of the mob said that they kind of propped him up. They grabbed him, propped him up against that, and that he was shot a couple more times after that. One of the old wives' tale was is that one was getting ready to cut him off his head, and there was a lightning bolt from heaven that stopped it. There's a lot around there, but yeah, he was probably dead very, very quickly, but still a little bit alive.
I was moved on my mission to another apartment, and we found where the missionaries had tried to make a death mask for somebody alive. You know, but there were straws up the nose, and then in it were all sorts of eyebrows that had been pulled out and everything. So getting it off must have been relatively painful.
Yeah.
That has to be cast again.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know if he did that or not.
That's funny. Anyway, so they bring him back. This back portion of the Nauvoo house, because this is like 1900, has been removed. So now from back here, it went farther down the street because it's back here where the bodies lie in state, where everybody and thousands of people come through this front door, which is still the stone stoop is still there where all the saints pass through that. They come through the kitchen's just back there and then back to where the bodies lie in state back over there. Okay. Then the next day, they have the funeral. They're gonna fill. There's still a belief that Joseph. There's a bounty on his head, so they hide the bodies. They fill two caskets with sand. They have a funeral procession. This is the first time that we have a new hymn introduced, written by W.W. Phelps, called "Praise to the Man Who Communed with Jehovah." Long shall his blood, which was shed by assassins, stain Illinois, while the earth lauds his fame. Which they then change. We now change. Yeah.
I heard that the mob. There was something that made them think that there were people to rescue
them. There is one story that says that when the mob first came up, there was a lady in the house, a couple of doors down from the Carthage jail, and she sees the mob coming, and she goes, "The Mormons are coming! The Mormons are coming!" She starts to yell, "The Mormons are coming!" And the whole martyrdom thing takes place in about, it's 520, and by about 525, it's done. And of that, she's still yelling, "The Mormons are coming!" And so some of that, they're starting to leave. And by the way, there is a third martyrdom, right? Samuel Smith is riding up. And he will be kind of viciously attacked, and he will die like the next day. So we don't always, there were three, but at this moment he's still alive when they're holding all of the funeral procession here. He dies within a day or two. And then Emma will have the bodies quietly in the middle of the night. The Nauvoo house, Mississippi's right here. The Nauvoo house is not yet completed. She will have the bodies buried, first of all, underneath there. She tells Mary Fielding one thing, and then in the middle of the night, she gets two brethren to help her, and she will bury them underneath there. And then she will remove them to another spot. She'll be buried with them. And then about 1901, the river is rising. They're not quite sure if it will disturb the graves. And they actually go looking for that, and they find the bodies. They will find the bodies of Joseph and Hiram and Emma, and that's when they will then be moved and put in the current place when you go to the Smith Cemetery in Nauvoo. And the last time, one of the last times we were in Nauvoo, and I tried to find it on the internet. It's not there, so I'm really kind of amazed. There was a brethren from the Community of Christ that had a book, and when those bodies were found, they actually took pictures of the skeletons of Joseph and Emma and Hiram. And he showed us a picture of their skeletons. And then the cement grave where they are now had three indentations to it. And he shows the skeletons being laid in each one of those little indentations, and then they put the top on it. So what's underneath that is those skeletons. But I looked and looked, and I couldn't find, I Googled like crazy, and I couldn't find any picture of the skeletons. But I've seen them, yeah. That's a good question, because Samuel's buried in the Smith Cemetery right there, next to his dad and Don Carlos, who had died like a year earlier. Okay. All right. A couple last things here. I think you're kind of interesting. This is John Taylor's grandson. One of the things that was a funeral idea at the time was that they would clip some of the hair from a body, and then they would either put them in a locket or something like that. In the case of Joseph and Hiram, this is a cane that belonged to Dimrick Huntington, okay, and it's made from the blood-soaked wood of the wagon that bore Joseph and Hiram from Carthage. So they made several. Emma had several canes made, and in each case, they'd take the cane, and then in this top part here, they would put a couple of locks of Joseph's hair. Okay, the most prominent of these canes being Brigham Young's cane. It's his black cane that when he comes to the Salt Lake Valley, remember, on July 24th, one of the first things he does is he walks over to this spot and he says, "We will build the temple of the Lord right here." And he marks it with the black cane with Joseph's hair in the top of it. Okay, you can go to the Daughters of the Mormon Pioneer Museum and see Joseph or Brigham Young's black cane that was made from that process. Yeah. No.
Did it swallow any other cane?
There was a cane. There was a sprouted cane that John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff. Dedicates on the altar of the Manti Temple. That's a story for another time. It gets into water witching and stuff like that. There's a whole other story there that we need to get it. Okay, so we're running late. I just want to finish with a couple of things here real fast. You guys are doing good. This is from the next day. This is from the St. Louis Evening Gazette. Late from Nauvoo. Joseph Smith shot. It appears the following that a crisis has occurred in the Mormon difficulties, which will be perhaps followed by further scenes of blood. The Mormons are going to rise up. Okay. Death of Joe and Hiram. Enclosed, you have a copy of the extra issued at Quincy. We left Nauvoo daylight this morning, the 28th. All was quiet. The Mormons have not heard yet of the death of the Smiths. Otherwise, they'd be tearing the place up. As Governor Ford, who was encamped a few miles back, had, as supposed, intercepted the messengers coming from Carthage. They didn't. Porter Rockwell's riding through Nauvoo like crazy. They've killed the prophet. At Warsaw, all was excitement. The women and children were all removed. Immediate attack was expected from the Mormons. We met the Boreas, whatever they're called, just above Quincy with 300 men and equipped for Warsaw, eager for a fight. Okay, that's what they're expecting. Okay, so last couple of things here. So we know what they were feeling around Illinois and stuff like that. Look at what they were saying in New York. Thus died the plowboy prophet of America at the hands of an assassin. The object of intense local persecution with Hancock County, where the feeling ran high, communities of Carthage and Warsaw, against his balance of power and the prophet. Yet beyond the vineyards of Hancock County, beyond the beautiful bend of the Mississippi, he was respected and admired prophet and statesman. So that's why I say there was ample feeling that a presidential candidate might have some power behind it. New York Sun. It's no small thing in the blaze of this 19th century to give to men a new revelation, found a new religion, establish new forms of worship, to build a city with new laws, institutions, order of architecture, to establish ecclesiastic, civil, and military jurisdiction, found colleges, send out missionaries, make proselytes in two hemispheres. Yet all of this has been done by Joe Smith and against every sort of opposition, ridicule, and persecution. Okay? And then finally, this is from Boston. Joe Smith is dead and gone. He was one of the most remarkable men of the age. The time for writing his history has not yet arrived. People that have known him well differ in his estimate of his character. The future historian alone can reconcile contradictory statements, place him in his true position. The personal manners of every man make him friends or enemies, regardless of their conduct. He was a man of rough exterior and coarse manners. Thousands who approached him were so completely disgusted by his manners, yet that they refused to look at the good he claimed to have done. But notwithstanding this, he was a remarkable man and has left an impressive his genius upon an age in which he lived. He carved out for himself a title to a page in history. His name will be remembered for good or for evil, while the names of half the ephemeral statesmen of this age will be forgotten. Isn't that great? He was a man of genuine courage and would have fought to the last minute of his life. He was pursued by a man of band of 300 infuriated demons and cruelly shut down like a wild beast while confined to a small room where he could not escape. It was a glorious exit for him. Whatever there was of evil in his heart will be forgotten in the recollection of his death. He will be eulogized by his disciples and worshiped as a god. Time and distance, and listen to this, time and distance will embellish his life with new and rare virtues. And more than any earthly power, his doctrines will flourish. His influence will extend to ages yet unborn, and future generations will celebrate his birth and death by public festivals, public prayers, and unlimited devotion. How about that? Isn't that cool?
Everything about his rough, coarse manner.
Yeah. But it just says that those that were watching and reading what he was saying and stuff like that saw, without kind of the prejudice of those living close by, what a great man he really was. So, yeah.
Kind of off topic. That's amazing. What's off topic is, so obviously you say that Joseph was shooting out the window. I never hear that anybody who was mobbed get hurt.
Yeah, he took when Hiram was killed. I'm a dead man, and so he takes the pistol, kind of little pepper shooter, and pepper box, and he cracks open the door, and he fires out the door. There he's got six shots, and he fires off all six shots. Three of them don't shoot, three of them do. So there were three men that were hit in the face by fire. Nobody dies, but they had these wounds. It's one of the reasons why they know. And they also end up all going to, they're all part of with Thomas Sharp and accused of murder because they got the evidence, you know, they got a wound on their face. But it was a small, if you look at the, when you go to the Church History Museum, you can see this little gun. It's like getting shot almost with a BB gun. I mean, not, these are very small balls. You'd really have to get shot in the right place to die from one of these things. But yeah, he empties that, he throws the gun down and then goes to the window. That's all they had, yeah. Other than what they called rascal beaters, which was Willard Richards, as the guns were, they couldn't shut the door. As the door's cracking open and all these rifles are sticking out there, Willard Richards is knocking them down as fast as he can, trying to knock off their aim a little bit. With the rascal beater. It's kind of that whacker rifle.
Civil War that they had.
They have rifles.
The cartridges and all of that type of thing.
So, no, they were just shooting balls that would just go straight as opposed to rifling, right. So they're moving faster.
And they didn't have the cartridge.
Yeah.
They didn't have all of that stuff.
So. No, you got one shot. You're going to pour that in there and you're going to fire off that ball. So. All right. Well. Thanks for staying a little bit late here. But I just think there's a lot here, and I've tried to point out some things that maybe you don't necessarily think about as part of the martyrdom. but I think it's, I remember you guys have been there, but historian Susan Easton Black said, in fact, she told me, where she said, I believe you can die and go to heaven without going to Nauvoo, but I'm not sure. And I believe that. There's something about standing there, but I do recommend if you go to Nauvoo, go off season. Go like in, even in February or March or something like that. It's cold, but you get the chance to really move very slowly through some of these sites. Because you go in July and it's a cattle call. You got 5 minutes in that room. Yeah.
And how much more did we appreciate our experience versus those sweet sisters who were there to preach? And we were thinking, honey, we love you, but can you tell us the history?
Yeah.
Spend time with the senior missionaries who were there and loved it and lived with us.
The missionaries are being, these sites, by the way, are now being moved within the last couple of years, are being moved from the, under the missionary department to the historical department. So they're going to be heavier on history, where before we walk through the house at Fayette, we're going to have to tell you how the church was restored and why it was restored and what Martin Luther said. And, you know, no, guys, we're all members. Just, we want to see the house. So it was. I was happy to see them move it to the historical department. So you should be getting more history and less preaching these days. Yeah.
Well, I'm from Illinois. I joined the church in 1969. All my education in Illinois. I have never heard about any of this until I joined the church.
Oh.
No. Western Illinois University is very close there. Nobody there knows who about it either. Now, of course, Nauvoo is a tourist attraction. Groups go up there on the buses, but I'm sitting here thinking how important it is, regardless of whether or not anybody hears this joint, how important it is to have this type of history preserved and told. So to think about tolerance and getting along with others, and all the important lessons that you can learn from knowing this story.
I was at a business meeting a few years ago at Rock Island. Illinois, right on the. And we're standing around there, and I said, I'm glad to be here and everything. I said, actually, my ancestors used to own land just farther down the river. And I said, where? And I said, in Nauvoo. And they go, really? What happened? I said, they were driven out by mobs. They'd never heard the story about that. I thought, well, isn't that interesting? It's not being taught.
Okay. Well, they used to have a wine festival.
Yes, they did. Oh.
People knew about that.
But. Oh yeah, the vineyards up there. One of the best bed and breakfasts is up there in the vineyards at the top of Parley Street. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. You guys are awesome. All right. Let's leave it with this. I just think there's a lot here. I love history and I can't get to Nauvoo enough. Love it. But anyway, bury my testimony. This is what prophets die. And they share their testimony with the world, and they're like it says in Doctrine and Covenants, their blood sealed their testimony. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Amen. Brent, could we get a closing prayer for you?
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.